I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we spend a few moments at the 5th International Conference on Hate Studies, held this week at Gonzaga University. About 20 years ago, Gonzaga founded its Institute for Hate Studies to give an academic home to the study of human rights. This was the era of the Oklahoma City Federal Building bombing. It was a particularly active time for the Aryan Nations Church over in Hayden Lake, and the battle waged against it by Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Every couple of years, the Institute, directed by Christine Hoover, invites some of the most prominent people involved in human rights studies around the nation and local people who are interested.
And if you were able to join us last night, welcome back. We had a wonderful kickoff with a pre-conference during the day, doing a workshop, Why Race Matters, an evening plenary session that highlighted our terrific Spokane County Human Rights Task Force and acknowledged the Kootenai County Task Force on Human Relations, and then went into several breakout rooms, including Bucking Bundy, Immigration Experience from Bhutan, and Implicit Bias. So if you're not feeling pulled in seven different directions yet, you may be later on in the day. Hopefully, there is much in this conference that you will be drawn to and you will find strength from.
Hoover says it's a particularly important time to hold a meeting like this, given the unrest in our civil discourse and the activity that has spawned.
The number of reported hate crimes in Spokane rose by 175% from 2016 to 2017, according to the FBI. There were 8 reports of hate crimes in 2016 and 22 in 2017. There's so many questions that we need to ask to have a better understanding and to get to the root causes and impactful actions. In Washington State, hate crime reports increased 61%, while nationally, reports increased 30%. From 22 hate crimes reported filed in Spokane last year, the most common were motivated by race, ethnicity, and ancestry. A few were also motivated by religion, sexual orientation, and gender. These are the realities that we need to shine a light on, and this conference is an opportunity for you to not only learn about these and other realities, but to be inspired by the amazing work that is also being done here and around the world.
Human rights and so-called hate studies are an academic genre that's growing. A handful of universities around the U.S. and Canada have programs. At least 2 of those are represented at this conference. Brian Levin directs the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism in San Bernardino, California. And Ken Stern leads the Center for the Study of Hate at Bard College in New York.
We're trying to get to be the model of how a small institution can really revolutionize the thinking about hatred and then trying to see that replicated in other places.
Stern has long spoken and written about anti-Semitism, and he wrote a book about the Oklahoma City bombing. He says Bard is trying to broaden human rights studies beyond sociology and psychology. He's reached out to faculty in many disciplines at the college to see how they can contribute to the field.
So the whole idea is to really set up a system where there's a new emphasis on the interdisciplinary aspect of hate and really exciting the faculty and the students to engage in this and, you know, on many levels.
Even with that energy at a handful of universities, Christine Hoover at Gonzaga says the field is still pretty small, and that's one reason why Gonzaga holds this conference.
There really aren't many other opportunities for people to come together when they're concerned about issues of treating people with less than human dignity. And so whether you're concerned about racism, whether you're concerned about misogyny, whether you're concerned about homophobia, we can learn from one another. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. And this is one of the very, very few places that can happen.
Although there was talk, I think Ken Stern was talking about, and Brian, they were talking about how more and more universities are doing this kind of thing. Can you talk about that, sort of that evolution at the academic level?
Yeah, there is I would say that there's a growing momentum. 20 years ago, the Institute for Hate Studies got started at Gonzaga. The next institute was the Cal State San Bernardino Center for Hate and Extremism. And so Brian Levin does a lot of work there, but he's done very, very important work
work on his own in that location, looking at national and international statistics. Now the Bard Center has come online, the Bard Center for the Study of Hate, and then also the University of Ontario Institute of Technology Center for the Study of Hate and Bias. And all of that together is under an under an umbrella, but because there are so many pockets of individuals who are wanting to be a part of this work, the International Network for Hate Studies is a distance group where we can all commonly communicate and work with one another. So as Brian was saying, to some extent, this is a soft launch of universities coming together so that we work in a both and sense, that we take care of our individual work, but we do so in a way so that we're not duplicating efforts and we're maximizing the impact that we can have.
Well, then what's the sort of work that's done in academic settings that sort of moves things forward?
So I think that there's a lot of work that Brian and Ken referred to that we don't necessarily understand as being under the umbrella of hate studies, because hate studies is a multidisciplinary area. So if you're studying about history and you're looking at how white supremacy got started after the war, you may not consider that hate studies, but you can absolutely share your knowledge in a way that contributes to the psychologist, that contributes to the sociologist, that contributes to criminal justice. And so when we're researching about racism, or in today's language, sometimes we also think about critical race theory as a better way of understanding so that we can critique what race means in a new lens, right? We're moving the conversation forward. At one point, we used to think about the melting pot, that everybody came together and we all blended in. And then we thought, well, you know, wait a minute, that doesn't really recognize my identity, my culture, and what's important to me. So then we move into multiculturalism. And a part of multiculturalism is moving forward towards intersectionality. So I am not just a white woman. I am not just an educated person. I am not just a person who teaches at Gonzaga University. I am all of that. And that kind of complexity is where we really need to understand the human condition, as opposed to just checking a box. You belong to this region. You belong to that category, whatever it may be, that really turns people into two-dimensional cardboard cutouts without the depth of relationship that transformation really requires in order to truly get at the roots of what's happening.
So I think about the term hate studies. What's meant by that?
Fundamentally, it's about othering, but othering is a very strange word. We use the term other in everyday language, and it's not a derogatory term. It doesn't have negative connotations. But othering means that you're less than I am. You're not as worthy. It means that you are detached from me, and we are not connected as human beings. And so when we think about someone as, when we think without compassion, when we don't have compassion for another one, we might think about why is that, and start with self, start with my own self-awareness. Why do I feel distant from another person who I am with in space or virtually? Where is my connection to that individual? And it's sometimes that path can lead to being overwhelmed, and then we also get paralyzed or have difficulty taking action. So the important part is to not only identify where I'm coming from and what my own personal work is, but where I'm going to focus that work to have greatest impact. A lot of times we have information overload, we have too many great things that are going on in our community, which is a wonderful problem to have, but at the same time, we also feel a little bit hopeless when we can't do it all.
Does the term hate studies, I mean, is that sort of exclusionary? I think there are a lot of people who don't like the work that you do, in part because they view that you're setting others, you know, you're setting people aside from each other. What do you think about that?
So there is a lot of concern about if we're going to talk about inclusion and the human condition, if what we aren't embracing is the idea that people, it is not okay to do harm to another. And whether that's a microaggression or a macroaggression, again, some of the work where academic research is heading, that is in the eye, whether it's a microaggression or a macroaggression, is whether it's about bias or stereotype or prejudice, or it actually moves into actual harm to physical or property or human beings. But the individual that's being harmed is really, the harm is still the same. Right? Words do hurt when we treat people as some stereotype that we might see them as belonging to. And so we are concerned with any type of othering, of any type of bias that doesn't include people. And that's where we want to meet people in their own context and say, what is it about you? Where are your belief systems? Where do they come from? How can we better understand them and respect them with the understanding that harm to another is not acceptable?
Would you consider a conference where you brought in a Ben Shapiro or somebody like that and have this conversation so that we're not just talking to the, you know, we're not just talking to each other who are part of this industry?
I think that that's a question that's very complicated and doesn't have a quick answer to it. But with great intentionality, we need to understand one another, and that means everyone. And we need to have some common ground in our understanding about listening to learn to one another. But those are fundamental principles that Jesuit education is built upon. And so with a great deal of thoughtfulness, we ought to consider what our options are.
As you read through the agenda, there are sessions with provocative titles, such as Beyond Punching Nazis, looking at the Western State Center's rhetorical counterpunching last year against white nationalists in eastern Washington. There are sessions that highlight academic approaches to human rights conflicts, peaceful approaches to improving the tenor of our public life, and stories from struggles in other places, from North Dakota to Africa. One session caught our eye because we're doing stories lately about homeless people and incarceration. It was a simulation that allows people to experience what it's like to transition from jail to regular society. That simulation is run by the Reverend Terry Stewart, a Methodist pastor from Seattle.
You kind of get to experience the wide range of starting points that people leaving prisons have and what their challenges are with reentry, especially focusing on relationships, social services, and income.
Here she hands out to a group of about 8 conference participants envelopes that contain colored tickets. They're like the resources that are given to people as they walk out the gates of a prison.
Green is like a money ticket, and blue is friends and family, like a favor ticket, and then the red is service cards. Service or social services, so like a mission, somebody that would put you in a homeless shelter, those kind of folks, right?
Stewart walks the participants through scenarios. How would you use your resources once you're released? Where are you going to stay that first night? Where are you going to eat? Not all of the participants are given the same number of tickets. They decide how to allocate their limited resources, and soon some run out and find themselves back behind bars. When the simulation is finished, Stewart gathers the participants in a circle to debrief.
What was your observations or reflections? Do you have anything you want to say?
It was hard to watch you guys go back to prison. Like, I saw all of you, like, meticulously counting your money and, like, what you had left, and, like, it was hard watching you make those decisions. And even you said you had to negotiate for a room, to, like, share a room with someone just to, like, make your money stretch out longer.
Even though I had run out by the time the game was over, yeah, the clock was ticking. It wouldn't be long.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have any income. There was no getting more of these.
I would have lasted through 6 months because I would be working before that. I would be, you know, I would have income coming in.
If you have felon next to your name, it's very hard to get a job.
You can go out and buy something and go out and sell it and make a living. Okay? There's a lot of ways to make a living. Create your own jobs. And that's one of the things we need to teach people, to be entrepreneurs.
This gentleman argued for more work release programs to move as many people out of jail as possible into situations where they can learn to make their own living. Afterward, Terry Stewart and I talk about the challenges of young people in making that transition from jail to free society.
So give me an example of somebody who's walking out. The day has come, it's free. What do they face as they walk out of those doors?
I can share a story of one of the youth that left juvenile detention when they aged out at the age of 18. And so they aged out at 18. They probably should have been on disability. Like, the staff should have helped them. They had some major challenges from a health standpoint, but they were denied, like, close. They were almost there, but they were denied. So because of their learning disabilities, they had a brain injury from a traumatic brain injury from parental abuse, right? They were placed in a group home, but to go from total control to this group home, and they're like, the rules of the group homes are like, you need to stay out of the house from 9 to 5 because you should have a job during that time. There's no way an 18-year-old just coming out of incarceration is going to poof, have a job, right? So then they're like, in the middle of Seattle, you're on the street from 9 to 5. This is not good for a young woman who has nothing to do. So within 2 weeks, she lost her placement at the group home and then was homeless. And so I taught her how to go grocery shopping, and then I would take her and drop her off under the bridge. I gave her a tent, right, just trying to help out as best I can. She was raped during that time. She was picked up for shoplifting, but it turned out she didn't do it. One of her friends did. Anyway, so then my whole goal actually became to get her out of Seattle, because there's a lot more youth there, which actually taps the resources. So if I could get her to the east side, there's less youth and more resources, which sounds counterintuitive. So I convinced a church in Kirkland, Lake Washington United Methodist Church, to convert one of their Sunday school classrooms into a room for her. So she moved into that room, kind of got stabilized-ish, went into Tent City. She's now moved to Tennessee. She's living with her dad. Like, it's been 5 years. So it's like a 5-year journey of what she has gone through. And so what didn't she have to do? She didn't have to be put in a group home that had no structure and capacity to deal with someone from detention. She did not have to be out of the house from 9 to 5, where she was then at risk for assault, right? So there's so many things that were, it's a miracle that she did not end up really in jail, but she had the relationships. So one of the programs that we run in detention and at Echo Glen is a mentoring program, so that we are connecting youth to people, building relationship, and creating transition plans, because I really believe that is what is transformational, and that's what's missing.
So what do you want for people to get out of a simulation like that?
It's like how, so we're going to have a coroner that's like, everybody goes back to jail. So how incredibly difficult this current system is for people to evade reincarceration.
And it's a system that's supposed to be helping young people.
One would say that, yes. So the I have recently looked up the state recidivism rates for our youth in Washington, and it's nearly 80% recidivism rates at a state level. The graduation rates for those youth is about 10%, and that's on the local school districts that run each school district. Wherever the facility is, that school district runs it. So those are horrible numbers.
So when you talk to, let's say, policymakers, local, state, what are the 2 or 3 things that they need to know that should be fixed, or at least to improve the situation?
Well, somebody's got to fix the schools. Like, and I don't even know how to do that, because it's each local school district and how you... So maybe there should be a state policy that sets a educational standard for the schools that are within the detention settings. So that might be nice. The other is one of the things that we were successful doing was being able to seal youth records, because that used to be not a thing in 2016, is I think when that law was implemented. All the records were wide open. Anybody could go look up anything they wanted to. So there's a percentage of them that can be sealed based on what their crime was. So widening that, making it so there's less.
Why is this important?
Because having the felony on your record impedes your ability to apply for college, to get housing. So it just creates a loop that is back towards incarceration. Does that make sense? So working with that, and then one of the things that we've done in King County is really start looking at restorative justice practices in a very real way. So one thing I learned when I was on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is that the most helpful practice that we have for to decrease recidivism is family therapy, right? So if you take a restorative justice approach that includes the whole family and the whole system, I believe that we can do that with our youth. And I mean, it's just chipping away at little tiny percentages everywhere, here and there. So, but doing whatever little thing you're called to do, go do it.
Terry Stewart is a Gonzaga doctoral student. She was appointed by the Methodist Church to work with young people in the community, and she directs the Youth Chaplaincy Coalition and spends time at several state-run institutions for children. She was honored at the conference with an award given in the name of Eva Lassman. She was a Spokane Holocaust survivor who spent many of her final years speaking to school and community groups about her family's experiences in the German death camps during World War II. The 5th International Conference on Hate Studies finishes Thursday at Gonzaga University. Tomorrow on the Inland Journal podcast, we renew our partnership with Spokane Faith and Values for a conversation about agreeing to disagree when it comes to civic discourse. To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can tell us what you think of the program by sending your comments to InlandJournal@kpbx.org. Call the listener comment line 509-232-6904. Thanks for your time. I'm Doug Nadvornik.